All right, that last statement right there, okay? Here you go. There's a word to describe that, and that one word is perjury.
Everybody, you're welcome. The doors.
Hey guys, I just wanted to hop in here at the beginning, per usual, and do a little bit of housekeeping. This is going to be a shorter episode. This was a short interview with Larry Peasy, a black belt who was working at the Image, and he will tell you all about that. I'll leave all that for him. Had a great conversation with him, and he is just really a character. I think his personality really comes through. We talk about him karate kicking Jim off the stage, quote unquote. He'll tell the true story behind that. He'll also talk about testifying. And I'm sure as you heard in the opening line, he talks a little bit about some perjury. Larry, it was a great interview. I had a lot of fun. I hope that comes across. Did want to mention that if you are listening to this Thursday on March 15th at the New Wave Restaurant and Bar in Bellflower, California, the group Strange Days is having a concert there. It's a 21 and over, starts at 10:30, and they are a great group. I think you guys will really enjoy them. I actually had the opportunity, the privilege of interviewing Forrest Penner. He's Robbie's guitar tech. We had a great conversation. The month of Miami has pushed that episode out a little further. It'll probably come out in the first week of April. It was a great episode. I told him I'd plug this concert, and I really want to make sure everybody gets a chance to see it and check it out, because he is probably one of the best. I would say that besides Robbie Krieger, he probably is the best Doors guitarist, tribute guitarist, to cover Robbie's music. So, and Robbie's even said that himself. So there's a lot of great ones out there, don't get me wrong, and a lot of great groups out there. But if you want to see him, be sure to go check that out this Friday at New Wave Restaurant and Bar in Bellflower. I haven't mentioned this in a while, but I know two friends of the show, Bob Batchelor and Jim Cherry, both have amazing books out. Bob Batchelor's Roadhouse Blues, Morrison, The Doors, and The Death Days of the 60s is a great cultural examination. And then if you want an almost like a blog type book, Jim Cherry's The Doors Examined is a great one as well. You can find both those on Amazon. I'd recommend checking them out because they complement each other well. I use them both for every episode I do, and I don't feel like I talk about them enough. So a shout out to both of them. I also do want to make a couple of corrections. During our conversation, Larry does talk about a bodyguard. He describes him as a big black bodyguard, and we have a discussion, and I sort of interjected that it could be Tony Funches. And that is an inaccurate assumption on my part after doing some research. Tony Funches was actually originally the bodyguard for the Rolling Stones after he got out of the Air Force, and he didn't join the Doors until after finishing up his obligation with the Stones after the Altamont Music Festival, which had been early December of 69, I think December 6th of 69. So the bodyguard Larry mentions was more than likely someone from the Sullivan Group, which would have been the company that Bill Siddons and the Doors had hired for the road security at the time. So again, correction there. I'm going to say Tony Funches. He's going to mention the name Tony, and that's wrong on my part. So just know that that is incorrect information. It is not Tony Funches. He was not with the Doors at that time. That's one correction I had. And speaking of Miami in March of 69, we do bring up Bill Graham, the Reverend Billy Graham, not the concert promoter. I always have to clarify that, and I'll make the same statement in the episode. But I did see in like a Miami Dade County group when I was doing research for this month of Miami, because this has been months in the making. If you listen to these episodes, they're all recorded at different times. Like I literally recorded the Miami, the very first episode of this month of Miami. I recorded it the last. So there's information that I'm very sure about there. But if you hear like here, I may mention something and seem very unsure. I recorded this 3 months ago in January. But in one of the Miami Dade County groups, I saw in doing research for that episode with Fernanda Mondi and Travis Williamson talking about the bootleg, there was a mention of Billy Graham. They're like, oh man, isn't it ironic that Billy Graham was walking the beaches of Miami and sharing the gospel with those on the beach the same exact day as the Miami concert? And I thought, what? Maybe it's not that big of a coincidence, but I thought that was just a funny, ironic thing. And I went and looked for it, and I could not find any evidence that suggested that that did happen. The closest thing I found in mentioning his name in Billy Graham in March of 69 was referring to one of the teenagers hold decency rallies. And this was from the Desert Sun on March 24th, 1969. It was almost like the Newport Jazz Festival, a 4th of July rally and a Billy Graham crusade rolled into one. And I never specifically saw anything that said Billy Graham was on the Miami Beach on March 1st of 69. But I did find something interesting in that he was at the Miami Hollywood Rock Festival, and apparently he was there on December 28th of 1969, later that year. And as he, you know, he's there, one of the things he says is he gets on stage, I guess he urges the young people to turn on to God. About 2,500 of them were there and 10,000 attended total. But then there's some shots of him in the crowd talking to some of the younger people about their beliefs. One of the things that makes this even more interesting is that this is the last festival of the 1960s. Technically, if you want to go by dates, the 1960s technically do not end, I guess if you're going decade wise, until the first year of the 70s would be 1971. I don't know. I got a Jeopardy question wrong because of that one time. But technically, any year starting with the number 196, the last festival would have been this one. And there were actually 43 festivals held total in the USA in 1969. I'd never heard of the Miami Rock Festival. It had B.B. King, Biff Rose, Canned Heat, Cold Blood, Crow, Grateful Dead, Johnny Winter, Paul Butterfield Blues Band, Santana, Vanilla Fudge, The Band, Turtles. You know, a lot of great groups from the Miami Herald. It drew thousands of young people determined to have fun and avoid paying admission if they could. It wasn't in Miami. It took place at the Miami Hollywood Speedway, then 15 long miles west of Hollywood, but now a housing development in the middle of Pembroke Pines. Fans were searched by police, lashed by cold winds, and encouraged to turn on to God by Billy Graham. Graham said he appreciated the respectful welcome he got, but police made at least 47 arrests and one young man died in a fall from a spotlight tower. So unfortunate news there, but that's what happened. So I wanted to throw that out there. And if anybody does have any information of Billy Graham being in Miami, I just did some cursory research and there could be very well be something I'm missing. If you have any information on Billy Graham being, it doesn't change the facts of Miami. It just sort of adds a layer of irony to it. If anybody does have anything they want to share, you can always send and anything in general. We're always looking for Doors experiences. If you've seen any shows today, the Doors played extended sets in New York throughout March at the Ondine. Always looking for tape from that show, any of those shows, or anything and any information you have in general. You want to tell your story. I do plan on doing a listener feedback episode in the future. Just send stuff my way and I'll read it on the podcast eventually. I just hope you guys are enjoying the podcast. I don't ask for this and I've got a little bit of time to fill at the beginning, so I'm just going to throw it out here. Would you, if you could, please leave like a 5-star review on any app you're listening if you enjoy this. And if you do want to leave like a 5-star review on Apple, it even just put in something like great podcast. Just put two words in there. But anything is helpful to get people to listen to podcasts. Share it with anybody, any Doors fans you have. I put a lot of work in this podcast. I don't make a dime off of it. In fact, I spend probably more money than I should making this thing. I've got some great interviews coming up. Forrest Pinner's one I talked about. I've got an episode on the Living Theater with Steve Wheeler, Doors author, friend of Frank Luciandro. I've got an interview with Brighton Bach, the artist who did the triptych for Jim Morrison on American Prayer, and he has some amazing pieces for sale that I'm sure people would jump to buy. I've got someone from the Venice Beach Historical Society. I think I'm going to do an interview with them. I'm still working on that. And he is, I think he was the archivist for Frank Zappa at one point. He was real good friends with him. And then I also am doing an episode with television critic and author of A Mystery of Mysteries, The Death and Life of Edgar Allan Poe, Mark DeWoodsiak. I've had him on in the past. He also wrote the book for Kolchak, the book for Columbo. He knows his stuff, and me and him talk about television history. We talk about all the shows that the Doors attended, and I don't know when that one's going to be out, to be honest with you. It's sort of like a two-parter. He enjoys the Doors music, but he's not a super fan. I'm looking for somebody to, in some schedules, you know, schedule permitting, I'm looking for somebody to sort of talk about the shows and the performances. And then he covers like talking about, you know, Zachary and him being a horror TV host, or Jonathan Winters and his acting career, you know, stuff like that. I don't know how I'm going to use that, but I recorded a bunch of stuff. Who knows how I'll morph that. I have talked so much here at the beginning. All that being said, any email, openthedoorspod@gmail.com. Thank you again to everybody, Mild Equator. Chris Simondette from there has been so helpful and amazing throughout the whole process. Travis Williamson, he's always an open ear that I can talk to. Jim Cherry, Bob Batchelor. The list of people to thank goes on and on. Without further ado, I'm going to stop rambling and I'm going to get into this episode. Former employee of The Image, Larry Peasy. Hey, Larry.
Hey, what's your name?
My name's Bradley Netherton.
Bradley.
Yes,
Bradley,
sir.
Bradley, listen, call me Larry.
Oh, well, Larry, it's nice to meet you, yeah.
The Doors concert. That was such a great night. You know, it was, wow. So we weren't even supposed to get that contract. We worked for the Image. There was Ken Collier, his brother Jim, Chuck Gross, and myself. And what I did was we worked at a place called the Image, and we did all of the bands from the 60s, you know, Canned Heat, Led Zeppelin.
Oh, yeah.
Iron Butterfly. Mike Panero was our house band at the Blues Image. Yeah, so that was the background that we were a concert hall. We converted a bowling alley into a concert hall. So what happened was the University of Miami got the contract for the Doors, but we were professional and they were educational, so the contract then went over to us.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happened was Bill Siddons, you know who Bill Siddons was in your research?
Yes, our Doors road manager.
Exactly. Well, he was very unhappy because I think we were paying the Doors, I'm not quite sure of the amount, but
I think it was 25,000.
Exactly so. It was 25,000. Well, he was most upset about that and wanted more money. So Kenny and myself, we met with Bill Siddons and a few other people outside before the concert. And Bill Siddons, he said, like, we won't go on. You give us more money or we won't go on. And Kenny, bless his heart, he said, hey, go ahead. Don't go on. He says, you'll never play another venue again.
Yeah.
So they agreed to play. Now, the auditorium, I don't know how to describe Dinner Key Auditorium to you. It was packed. There were people. I remember this one guy, he climbed up on the roof, and he put his feet against one wall and his back against the other. And he chimneyed down about four stories. You know,
wow.
And when he got down there, I was waiting for him. And I said to him, I said, like, okay, kid, you're in. You made it. Anybody that's got enough nerve to do that, you can do it.
Another thing that seemed like it was indicated by Doors management was that the Diner Key was oversold by a few thousand. Is there any, and maybe that was the Doors camp making that up, I'm not really sure. Do you think that the venue was oversold? Do you think Ken might have oversold it, or who would have been in charge of the tickets?
Might have oversold the auditorium?
Yes, sir.
You know what? I honestly do not remember. I know we had fire marshals and police and everybody there. It is possible that it was oversold. To be honest with you, there was something that we had done in the past.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
You know?
You know, that was,
yeah.
I know you're probably familiar with Bill Graham, famous concert promoter. And in the South, in the South, a lot of times, if you say Bill Graham, everybody thinks you're talking about the pastor. And then they get confused when you start talking about him riding a big blunt through the sky. I don't know if you remember that at the Winterland.
Yeah.
But he would often, he was always accused of overselling venues as well. But what he would do is, I guess, take the tickets as they came in, and he would keep the tickets and then go back outside and sell them on the street.
And then resell them.
Yeah.
I know that. I tell you what, when we did Jimi Hendrix, I guarantee you that they were oversold because I was overselling because I worked the security. And so what I did was, you know, set up the guards on the entrances and exits and shit. And what I would do, you know, I'd go get money from 20 or 30 people and slip them in through the side door. So in all probability, that concert was oversold. If you said, okay, your life depends on this answer, I wouldn't be able to answer that question. But the probability is,
The
stadium was packed to the gills, you know.
Yeah, and it's March in Florida, so I'm sure that contributes to it. Which, by the way, how did you end up in Portland? Because didn't you were in Florida for a while, and then I saw in a karate group that you were in close to Atlanta, Georgia at one point. What got you all the way out in Portland?
I moved to Atlanta. No, my daughter, I have a daughter, and my daughter, she got the big job. What she does is she runs a high-end surgical veterinarian clinic.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And I told her she could leave, but she had to leave my grandchildren, and she said no. So here we are.
Wow.
Here we are in Portland. Oh, wow. I love it up here.
Do you really? Yeah, well, that's awesome, man. Yeah.
I don't love the blizzard that we just lived through.
Yeah, my mom goes to Oregon sometimes. She'll go up that way, but I have never been. I need to make it out there one day.
Oh, it's physically beautiful. It truly, truly is.
I bet. Back to the show. Sorry, I'm very prone to get off track here. So the Dinner Key Auditorium, if I remember correctly, the backstage area didn't really have a backstage, so it was off like at a balcony, I believe. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yes, indeed, it did. Yes.
Yeah, I was looking through your.
Yes.
So I found. So I think I told you how I found your name was in the transcripts. I found your testimony and some of the stuff that you talked about. And at one point, I think you talked about going in there and you saw some beer back there, and Jim Morrison, of course, appeared pretty drunk. Do you remember anything else like before the concert? You said you got their autographs too, as well. Do you remember getting their autographs? Did you still have them?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. I gave those to my daughter years ago. Oh, God. But in the amenities, you know, for the green room, you have to supply the green room.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that you supplied the green room with was alcohol. Yeah, and Morrison, he was pretty well smashed. I want to say pretty well smashed. He was smashed. Yeah, he was definitely, he had definitely been imbibing.
Yeah, yeah. Does your daughter still have those by chance? She wouldn't be looking to sell, would she? Just a question.
I don't know, but I'm going to call her and tell her that somebody asked that question. You know, would you like to sell that Dinner Key Auditorium thing?
Because, I mean, that's a pretty cool piece. Yeah. I mean, even if I'm not the buyer, I could probably find somebody who'd be a buyer for it, you know? But that's a pretty cool, it's a cool piece either way though. So the concert gets underway. It's pretty packed. And so Ken, did he usually have, you mentioned you had people at the door. Would they stay at the door like the whole time, or how did the security work on that?
No, once the concert was well underway, everybody was just watching the show.
Yeah.
Yeah, there wasn't any blocking the exits or anything like that. They just, everybody, you'll have found in your research, Ahern.
Yes, I did,
great guy.
Yeah, Patrick Ahern.
My job, Bradley, was to make sure that everything went well to get the band on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
Because once they were on the stage, I was finished. You know, the security was done, and I had gone back to the green room, and the band got up, and they started playing. Morrison's really drunk. He start egging the crowd on to come up to the stage to get onto the physical stage.
Yeah.
What I did was I ran downstairs. The people around the stage, they were cramped like sardines. And what I did was I physically climbed over the on people's hands and shoulders and heads and got to the stage. Physically walked over the top of them. Now, Morrison is there. If you could see me waving my hands around, it'd probably help. But but Jim Morrison is trying to get the people up on, helping people up on the stage. We're pushing people off of the stage. Though at one point, Ken turned on the house light. Morrison, at one point, there was a big black guy there. I remember. I don't remember his name. But he was with the Doors. He was one of Morrison's bodyguards. But anyway, what happened was he grabbed Ken Collier and locked him up. Well, I grabbed Morrison and locked him up, you know?
Yeah.
It was really neat because it wasn't, you know, Ken and Jim, they were just pawns in the game. They had not, this was a battle between me and Tony, you know?
Yeah.
It was like, hey, Tony, my guy's more important than yours. Let him go.
Wow. Because I think because that last 5 minutes is chaos. Like if you listen and it doesn't all get, I don't know if you've heard, you're familiar with the Miami tape, correct? Or you've heard some of it or
no,
any?
No, I'm not. I've never
heard it?
I've never interviewed. never went back and did the records or seen the tapes or any of none of that.
Man, because it's it's an interesting piece because it's so famous, history. Especially because it's, and you're a part of that history too. I mean, that whole ending, I don't know if a lot of people know, but like, you know, so there's a bustle on stage and then right there at the end, did you kick Morrison off the stage? Is that factual?
No. Yes, it is. But what happened was this.
Mm-hmm.
Morrison grabbed me from behind and he was pushing me towards the edge of the stage to push me off of the stage. In the terms of karate, it's called Tai Savat. And what I did was, as I got to the edge of the stage, I remember to this very day what I did. I took my right foot and stepped to the left and turned around. And Morrison went flying off like Superman. It was like, but the most amazing, I have to tell you this because it's a scene I'll never forget in my life.
Yeah.
It looked like water draining down a bathtub drain because every head in the crowd turned in unison and watched him in the air. And then when he hit the crowd, they caught him.
Wow.
And they put him to his feet. And as he's running to the green room, the crowd parted like the Red Sea and Moses. It was great. Then I got off of the stage and went to the green room and went up there and talked to them, you know. And that's the point where I got the band's autograph, actually.
Wow. So there wasn't you. You know, I'm sure it's pretty easy taking a drunk guy, you know, already being sort of a karate expert, you know, or being a karate expert. But the fact that it's Jim Morrison and then you go to the green room after. Well, I mean, was there any animosity to begin with? Or what does he say when you?
None whatsoever. And I spoke to him and I'll tell you something else, too. When I testified, I was truthful, but I was pro band.
Yeah.
I was pro Morrison. I tried my best to you know, say things that weren't as bad as what the newspapers and the whole nine yards what they were trying to say. I was doing my best to do that.
Yeah. So one of the
it was quite tonight.
Yeah. If you don't care, I'm gonna just go over some of your testimony with you and we can talk because I got that feeling too. One of the things that you talked about was they asked you if you'd seen any exposure, of course, because Jim supposedly said the, you know, you want to see, you know, it and all that. Did you at the balcony, maybe it's harder to see. Did you ever see Jim expose himself at all?
You know what he had done was he was wearing leather pants and he had pulled his underwear up.
Yeah.
And down. And to answer your question, I would have to say no, I didn't.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Because he's been pardoned now, so I don't know if and he's deceased, so I don't know if the state of Florida's gonna do anything about it now. But yeah.
I mean, my God, in 1969, you might as well ask me about the cocaine use with Jimi Hendrix, okay?
Wow, dude, Man, now you've got me curious on Hendrix, man, because Hendrix is another one of those guys who's amazing. Yeah.
Jimi Hendrix was the coolest person I've ever met in my life.
Really?
Yeah, that guy was great. He was just great.
Man, tell me a little. Okay, we'll go off on a Hendrix tangent here because I want to hear. Well, tell me a little bit about Hendrix because he played in Miami, of course. Can you tell me about meeting him and what y'all talked about or anything like that?
Oh my God, yeah. Well, you know what? Back in those days, we're big recreational drug usage, and now I live in Oregon where everything's legal, and I don't do recreational.
it's like what you wished for, you know, back then, man. And you're like, 55 years too late, you know. I watched Easy Rider for the first time today. I'd never seen the movie. I watched it, and it was a pretty enjoyable film. The ending, like the last 20 or so minutes, I'm like, man, that's a bummer of an ending for a film.
Yeah, it's great.
So there was always rumor, you know, because if you listen to the tape, so at the end of the Miami concert with the Doors, Ken Collier comes up to the mic, and he said, everybody, cool it, somebody's going to get hurt. or something along those lines, because, you know, they thought the stage was going to collapse or anything. Did the stage, some people say the stage did collapse. Did you remember the stage collapsing?
No. The stage never collapsed. The concert ended when the house lights came on. Kenny turned the house lights on. He ran over to the drummer and he took the drumsticks away and smashed the drums. He stabbed the drums. So the drums were finished. I mean, the drums were the driving beat of the whole thing.
Wow.
So that was pretty much the end of the concert.
So after that, you make a beeline to Jim, and Tony Funches is the bodyguard's name. Did he come after you too, or how did that all go? Jim goes.
No, he didn't. There was nothing towards animosity towards anybody on anybody's part.
It was just all sort of a chaotic moment.
I got to speak to Morrison at the trial, and said, no, just the nicest guy.
Some of the other things that have been mentioned, I don't know if you would have seen, like Jim Morrison supposedly got paint thrown on him at one point, and if you see his pants, he has like this orange paint still on it. If you go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and see the pair of pants he wore at the Miami show, that was the last time he ever wore those, the brown leather pants. Do you remember that?
I don't know how that would have happened. No.
Yeah, and then
no,
there was,
I don't. No one threw paint on him. Certainly not from our side. And the crowd, the audience, everybody loved him. It was great. Yeah. No, there was no. Yeah, it was very memorable adventure.
But he was very in. I guess
yeah, to, I loved every bit of it.
Yeah, to the living theater. I know he was very like call to action at this point. And so, if you listen to the tape, there's some boos here and there. But most of the time, he had such a way to bring the crowd back in and get the cheers back from them. But he was like, you know, I'm not talking about a revolution. I'm talking about love. You know, come up here. Is anybody going to come up here and love me and stuff like that throughout the show and wow. Until the end, where he's like, you know, they can't. I think he said some statement like they can't tell you what to do. You know, get on stage. This is your show. Come up here. And then that's when the ending happened, and you come from the balcony and try to, you know, stop it.
Yeah, that was pretty much it. That was pretty much it.
So
I have one more tiny little thing of jigger.
Yeah.
I think the tickets were $5 or $6.
Mm-hmm. Man, I love that nowadays.
But anyway, I went to bed that night with, I had something like $70,000+ in a small bill, you know, and the next day I went to the bank and I'm in line with two suitcases. And the guy behind me, I said to him, listen, you might want to get in another line. And he just looked at me and sort of sneered. And I opened up that first suitcase in the teller's face.
Oh, man.
And she said, the guy behind me, she said, sir, you might want to get in another line. I'm going to close mine.
They probably didn't have those automatic counters back then, did they?
No, there were no counters back in the 1960s.
Three, four,
But that was also the end of the image. I mean, you know, the Doors, I don't think they ever did another concert after that, but
they canceled a whole whole bunch of shows. They ended up getting some more concerts, but it was never the same after that. I think they played like, you know, because LA would have them out west would have them. They could pretty much perform. Mm-hmm. And I think they ended up talking like they'd play like Madison Square Garden. But then they got like Felt Forum. They were able to do some shows at the Felt Forum, some smaller venues. I mean, they did some. And then they had like a whole, in 1970, they had a run of shows. They played the Dallas State Fair. And then their last show was at the Warehouse in New Orleans, which is a very, you know, I'm not sure how familiar you are with the Warehouse, but, you know, this. Sort of like I know in my area, because it's sort of, I guess Miami, you would have had stuff, but Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, well, not probably not Georgia, but more like Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas, and of course, Louisiana. A lot of people from the South went to those shows. Then, you know, a lot of people performed there. I know one of the Allman Brothers performed there, Grateful Dead performed there and stuff like that. So that was sort of the South's biggest venue outside of Florida. You know, the Florida, I don't really consider the South as much, like it's sort of like its own unique place, you know, but as far as I guess the other southern part, you know, that was how it happened. There were, so I've got a couple more questions and I'll let you go, man. You've been so helpful, with all this. So there was, so Patrick Ahern, I don't know if you're familiar, there was a tape that was made on the stage. They had a tape recorder on the stage and made a tape of the show. But there was also somebody, that was, I think Patrick Ahern had, or one of the Echoes had made it. I'm not really familiar, but somebody had made it on the stage and they made that tape. But also there was a guy in the crowd who said that he had a tape recorder in his breast pocket and had made a recording of the show. And as he was leaving, he said that he was leaving the venue and that somebody, a security person, stopped him at the door and took the tape from him. Was that a practice at all, or would that have been a practice?
No, that would not have happened.
Okay.
That what you're saying, I guarantee you it did not happen. Number one, how would security know that he had the recorder in his pocket or on his person?
Right.
Number two, the amount of people, the sheer number of people leaving the auditorium. But more important than that, there was no security at the gates anymore.
Yeah.
Those guys, after that, once the show started, nobody was interested in pulling in the last ticket to get somebody in there.
Yeah.
You know, everybody was enjoying the show. Whether somebody in the crowd saw him with it and decided to say they were security or whatever, I'm not saying the guy is telling you a lie, but I'm telling you that no security or City of Miami policeman would have taken that tape.
Yes. Okay.
That did not happen.
I also have, I do have documentation on this that Ken Collier, Ken Collier at one point, he made sort of like he threatened the doors legally, which, and this is per Bill Siddons.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
He did.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
If you remember when the conversation first started with Bill Siddons, outside before the concert started.
Yeah.
Bill Siddons said, we will not go on.
Yeah.
And Ken said, don't go on. Do not go on. Because if you don't go on, you'll never play anybody again.
Yeah.
What's the musical union? We had a valid contract. The contract was absolutely ironclad. Ken said to him, do not go on. Don't go on. And if you don't go on, you'll never play another concert again.
Oh, yeah.
So that was the threat. I know that for a fact because I was there.
Yeah, wow. This legal threat would have been after the show, like a few days after.
No.
You don't think that?
No.
Okay.
No. No.
Okay.
No, the legal threat was before. I don't believe that Kenny's been dead for, Jesus, 25 years, 30 years already.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, anyway. But no, I don't believe that we had any contact with the doors other than myself being subpoenaed and testifying in the trial.
I guess my idea was that I didn't know if Ken Collier would have had people who would have taken the tape, seeing the importance, seeing how the show went at the time. I mean, I don't know if did he seem mad after the show? Did Ken seem like he thought, man, you know, that was a train wreck or anything?
Listen. The purpose of having for a promoter to do a contract and to do a show is to make money. We had $70,000+ that night.
Yeah.
Last thing he was worried about.
Yeah. No, I understand. Yeah.
Yeah, no. We were thrilled. Yeah.
Wrapping up, I'm sorry. No, thank you so much for your time, man. Was it, I guess, I know you ended up being subpoenaed. How nerve wracking is that, getting subpoenaed and having to go on this trial like this, sort of nationally televised? I mean, it's not nationally televised, I guess, the way things are nowadays. But I mean, even when the doors played in Bakersfield, like there were interviews with Jim outside the courthouse and being broadcast around the world, you know?
Yeah. No, it didn't bother me at all.
Okay.
Not at all. You know, there's one thing about myself. I'm actually a very simple, honest person. You know, you call me up and you ask me for this interview, and I answer your question as honestly as I can.
Yes, sir.
And it was the same thing. And I, what I didn't realize at the time was that how this thing would carry on. I mean, afterwards, when the whole thing's over and it was in Rolling Stone and all of that, you know, and I had one guy walk up to me and he said, "You're Larry Pizzi, you're famous."
Wow.
But it means nothing to, it means nothing to me. It means nothing to me. It was a great memory. I had a wonderful time. Well, I wouldn't have missed it for the world if I could change my life and any of that kind of stuff, you know. It's just another adventure that happened.
Yeah, reading through your testimony, I just the way because the state is really badgering you at some point. And you're like, "Hey, you know, did you smell anything?" He said, "I might have smelled some beer on Jim. I was face to face with him." They said, "Would you say he's drunk?" He said, "No, I don't think he was drunk." And the state's really trying to badger you to get you to say,
"All right, that last statement right there." Okay,
here
you go. There's a word to describe that. And that one word is perjury.
Like, well, I don't know if he was exactly drunk. I smelled beer on him, but I don't know if he was exactly drunk. Oh, man.
That was perjury. Okay.
Well, I think a statute of limitations is up on this. So I think we're okay.
Yeah. If you remember correctly, I told you the guy was definitely drunk. Definitely. Yeah. Smashed, I think, was the word that I used.
Well,
he was absolutely drunk.
Well, we'll I don't think they're gonna come after you nowadays. Hopefully not. Well, hey, Larry, thank you so much, man. This is great talking to you.
I want you to do something for me. When you finish this, when you finish this project.
Yes, sir.
And you got my phone number, call me up and send me a copy of whatever it is, because I'd love to read it, you know.
Yeah, well, I've sort of been recording this phone call, so I thought about doing it like a almost like a radio interview and chopping it up and making it a little bit more cohesive. Uh-huh. And I'll definitely get you a copy, man. That would be great. I'm hoping, because
that sounds great.
It's sort of arbitrary. I think it's 55 years this March 1st. So hopefully I'm going to get it done by then. But who knows, man? Who knows?
55 years.
Yeah, man. I tell you what, it's crazy, ain't it?
Oh, man.
Man, hey. Well, Larry, I don't
Mr.
know.
Mr. Bradley.
Larry, thank you.
Great to talk to you, buddy.
Yeah, I can tell. Always great talking to another Southern gentleman like yourself, you know. So appreciate your time, Larry. You have a good day, man. Hopefully the blizzard. We've got 1 inch of snow and it shuts down everything in Alabama here. So hopefully y'all are doing a little bit better in Portland.
Well, you know what? In Oregon here, like there was like 8 inches of snow. But what happens is the roads are all good. They take care of the roads up here. This is not, they know how to handle it. It's not like Alabama where, you know, the stores don't have any bread and milk.
Which I never did get this. I guess it's a psychological thing that people don't want the bad weather to last long, so they get perishable items. But who knows what that's all about, man? That's nuts. That is absolutely nuts.
Well, all right, partner. I got to run inside anyway.
Yes, sir. Yeah, thank you for sitting outside the grocery store and talking to me, Larry. You have a good day, man. Hopefully you find everything you want. Get a loaf of bread and some milk for me, man.
And eggs.
Yeah, can't forget about eggs. Thank you again to Larry Pizzi. You can find this podcast on Twitter, at The Doors Pod, and on Facebook by searching for Opening the Doors. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions for guests, you can send an email to openingthedoorspod@gmail.com. I want to give a special thanks to podcast consultant Jim Cherry, who authored The Doors Examined and The Last Stage. Music for this podcast was done by Christian Cornejo of the Jimbo Tribute Band from South America. I hope to meet you back here in 2 weeks, but until then, keep the doors open and the music loud. What?